we clearly live in pivotal times at the moment. I would say the short answer to your question is both. We have some companies or some areas that are really getting hammered by AI, and where like no sane founder should start a software company right now, but rather really focus completely on AI and agents, and really just skip the human level, so the user interface level. But there are a lot of other areas where, for the foreseeable future, we see humans and AI coexist, and it's very hard to believe that like it's completely replaced.
This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action, with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. We interview normally SaaS companies, SaaS leaders. We talk about different topics around SaaS. This time, it's more than just one SaaS. It's a SaaS group, which I would like to talk with. And the experience comes from aggregated SaaS companies all together. And I'm very pleased to have Tim with me. Tim, please tell us a little bit about yourself and about the company. Welcome to SaaS Scale.
Yeah, hello, and thank you very much for having me. My name is Tim Schumacher. No relation to the race car driver, by the way. I get asked that all the time. It's a very common German name. I'm German, live in Germany, but our group is very international. It's remote first, so we don't have a headquarter. We do a good chunk of our business in the United States and Canada, but also very strong in Western and Eastern Europe. With a headcount globally across the world, close to 400 people. And yeah, as you said, we're not one SaaS company, we're SaaS group. So we're acquiring small SaaS companies, usually somewhere between $1 and $10 million or euros in revenue. And then we try to take those companies to the next level, preserve what is good, preserve what made them strong, but also fix and improve the things that can be fixed. And we believe that with this approach, we can actually take SaaS companies, small SaaS companies, to the next level. And we're building an independent group of independent SaaS companies that way.
Fantastic. And how did you end up thinking about it and doing it? What you did before, it led you to what you do today? Or it was, what did trigger that event that one day you came and said, I'm going to really start thinking seriously about having a SaaS group?
Yeah, I was an entrepreneur before. So I started a company called Cedo.com, a domain marketplace, actually the world's largest domain marketplace. So kind of the buying and selling of domains and project, I think that was a defining part of my very first company. I also founded and ran the company behind the popular ad blockers, Adblock and Adblock Plus, for quite a while. And I did a lot of angel investments. And kind of two things, I would say, led to the foundation of SaaS Group. On the one side, for anyone who has done angel investments, it's very enjoyable. You get to meet a lot of founders, but also you can't do much. Like, you give someone money, you trust them, and for better or worse, it'll work out or not work out. And on the other side, I saw all those little SaaS projects there with great founders who got this project to $1 million, $2, $3, $4 in revenue, but then they were often hitting some sort of glass ceiling. They didn't know how to scale, or they hated scaling. I've seen a lot of founders who love that early 0 to 1 product market fit phase. But then when it comes to scaling, they're like, ooh, I got to manage people. I got to manage customers. It's like all, it becomes more of a burden than an actual fun. They enjoy building, not running things. And actually, I do enjoy running things. And so I was like, okay, let's put 1&1 together and start acquiring those projects. And I started with one, and then it kind of, accelerated at some point. And now we're close to 30 companies, over 100 million in revenue altogether. And it's become a real group of companies. And but it's fun. I enjoy running those SaaS companies.
Congratulations. That's a very good milestone. Then understanding that you guys, started, I believe you said 2018. That's a great milestone to reach there, and just having, all of these companies combined 100 million ARR is a big accomplishment. Now, exit is one of the major topics in the mind of many SaaS and software in general founders. And when they start a company, of course, they have to think about their exit strategy. Some founders may build a company, bootstrap, some may go and receive some funding. My guess is that you are introducing a new way of exit to these SaaS companies that maybe never existed, at least for many of them in the past. Maybe that's a kind of the type of exit that, by looking at the characteristics, is not as traditional as they could just go and just talk to, an investor and they buy the company or something like that. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of option you bring to the table to these SaaS companies that maybe never has been so readily available to them?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. That is a great summary. And indeed, that was the market niche we've targeted from the beginning. If you grow a company, it becomes really big, you'll have a strategic interest, you'll have private equity, you might even have an IPO. If your company is smaller than 10 million revenue, you've succeeded. You've created something that probably 99% of SaaS founders really aspire to create. Still, it's actually hard to sell those. Or same if you took a little bit of angel and VC money, the VCs are hoping for some fund returner. If you're a 5 million revenue company, they view you as a failure. You're not a failure. You are like, again, you're probably more than what 95% of SaaS founders wanted to create. Yet, you don't get resources from the VCs. They won't finance you further. You're just kind of tugging along. And then actually for the VCs is actually a great exit, but likewise for bootstrap founders. If we have so many founders that run a company for 10 years and then they're like, oh man, I really want to do something else again. I've done this for 10 years. I've seen it. Then as you said, we provide great liquidity. And we also promise to take the company as is. We don't fold it into a big structure. We actually let the company run independently. We staff it with the right people. We also make sure that the founder works on his or her terms on the exit. We have some founders who are like, I'm burned out. I can't do this anymore. And like, you have 4 weeks and I'm out. And we have others who are like, okay, I'll give you 2 years. I'm going to do an earnout. I'm going to do like my best in those 2 years. And maybe I'll stay after that, but I just want to take some chips off the table. And both is fine. And I think that's really also our differentiating factor compared to a PE. We're like real operators. We can work with any company, even if no employee comes with it or the founder says, hey, I'm out after 4 weeks. We can actually work with them because we have people who understand SaaS. We have marketers, we have developers, we have all the different qualifications that are needed. So essentially we're a different type of acquirer that hasn't existed before.
That's great. And I think that's a very true, and that's a great exit option to have for many entrepreneurs, as you said, that maybe, they don't want to scale because, or they don't want to go to, you know, institutional investors, because at that point the risk is higher, they may lose control or something. And then at that point, maybe the decision to, you know, this is a much better, more controlled kind of exit, more predictable from founders' perspective outcome, to really come and just talk to you guys rather than go and just raise series A, B, C and go through that route that at the end of the day may or may not necessarily result what they want. So very understandable. Having all said, we are at a very particular time at this point, and that is about really software. Many people believe that software is not going to be the same in the future. And enterprise software, and I have to believe that most of your software products and companies are B2B. But when we are talking about really the enterprise software, we are talking about business software. And then it comes to the point that AI now is a major part of this ecosystem. And many people think that the agentic AI and essentially automating the automation, and not just the software automation, but also the human part, is going to change as well. Meaning that for the first time, software not only is a tool that makes us more productive, AI as a technology, as a software technology, is going to replace human and not only help us to make better decision, but make the decision. So if that's true, and we are already there, and some people believe that it takes time to get there, then the role of software companies may change. Many people ask the question, is AI the future of software? Or still software companies remain relevant? In other words, if I'm a founder, I wanted to start my SaaS company and build software, should I build models and train models and build really the kind of the AI logic, or is okay if I start building software and that business is still is going to stay and AI is going to be another layer on top of it? What is your perspective on the whole ecosystem and where we are, since you are working with a good number of software companies as the whole group?
Yeah, no, great question. And we clearly live in pivotal times at the moment. I would say the short answer to your question is both. We have some companies or some areas that are really getting hammered by AI, and where like no sane founder should start a software company right now, but rather really focus completely on AI and agents, and really just skip the human level, so the user interface level. But there are a lot of other areas where, for the foreseeable future, we see humans and AI coexist, and it's very hard to believe that like it's completely replaced. What we're clearly seeing is that every business, and yeah, we have the luxury of seeing 25 of them. Every business is disrupted in its own fashion. Some are actually, undergoing bigger shifts, but there are also other ones who have a real boom due to AI. I'll give two specific examples from our portfolio. One is scraperapi.com. It's a scraping service. So as the name says, it's an API to scrape data. And of course, LLMs are hungry for data. And so that business has been doing really well in the last 2-3 years, because it is exactly what the agentic web needs and what LLM needs. Or what we also have is a business called AirShare. And what AirShare does, it's a very lightweight and easy way to plug social media APIs into your systems. And what happens now is, you know, you code something with Claude or Lovable or one of the many tools, AI tools out there, and that automatically then connects to systems like AirShare, because that's the best way to actually connect social media systems, and you have to have this sort of interface. And so also very much growing at the moment, partially due to an AI boom. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have services that are more UX focused. For example, Tower, it's actually a pretty cool tool for a graphical Git client. But that's hard at the moment because graphical Git clients are really kind of going out of fashion when a lot of people are going into vibe coding. So it's really a broad spectrum, and we're seeing it all along. And I think it really, things are much more multifaceted than what the headline suggests, namely that either, you know, nothing will happen or that AI will kill everything. I think it's, as always, somewhere in between.
Yeah, very good point. And besides, anyway, these kind of agentic, you know, layers that we are talking about, you know, they need data and they need applications, right? So it's not like in a vacuum, you can just develop these agents and they will do everything on their own. They're still relying on many of these API calls, many of these applications that need to be designed or redesigned in a way that they are agentic kind of friendly. And they can really work with all of these agents and provide the service, the data they need. And I see on the data side, at least that's where I'm coming from, you know, getting to that quality data that can really empower all of these businesses and all of these models and all of these, it's a long way to go. We are not there. We are not at the point that we can say, okay, we solved that problem. We are done with that. Let's move now to the AI layer. It still is a long journey there and a lot of work to be done.
Yes.
Yeah. And probably on your side as well, you know, experiencing and working with data, you know, you probably have the same kind of experience that, you know, when it comes to data you know, analytics, there's still a large volume of work to be done and a lot of work to be done. Now, I know that you mentioned you are based in Europe. Does it mean that you only function and you only work with SaaS companies and software companies in Europe, or you are actually expanding and working across the ocean as well, and you are very active in the US too?
Yes, we're very active in the United States and Canada. Actually, the majority of companies and brands we bought in the US and Canada. And it's also our biggest market. I think close to half of our revenue is actually in the United States, and another, I think, 10% or something in Canada. And Canada is actually a strong base. We've got, I think, almost 40 people in Canada. Europe is a little bit stronger on the people side. Salaries are more affordable, in particular in Eastern Europe. So we have a very strong base there. But yeah, now we're a truly global group. We are really across both sides of the ocean. Yeah, that's what also makes us strong. I think we're seeing a lot of perspectives. We have also a lot of digital nomads. We have Americans living in Portugal, and lots of people actually living in Spain and Portugal who are not from there. That's a favorite destination. But also lots of other people living in Germany. Berlin is popular with foreigners in Germany. It's a quite a cool city. And the other way around. And so we have a broad perspective on the world and lots of nationalities, over 40 different nationalities and very diverse workforce, independent of location. And we feel that's the right thing to run a SaaS company.
Yeah, especially diversity can help in variety of ways, including when you have a bigger problem to solve, you have to have people from, you know, different mindset and different background and expertise to be able to solve those bigger problems. Now, for us, not knowing a lot about the European market is always a question from the SaaS perspective. Where are the areas or which countries in Europe are more into the SaaS kind of market? And when I say SaaS, AI included, but I'm talking about the subscription software revenue part, that, you know, software companies that they are actually bringing recurring revenue. That's my broader definition of SaaS. Yeah.
So I mean, SaaS is the prevalent model of selling software everywhere in Europe, just exactly like it is in the United States. Europe is a very heterogeneous market. I think that's one of the problems we have, but we're over 500 million people. So it's a huge market, but it's very, like, people tend to think less of Europe, but they think of, okay, France and Germany and the UK and Spain. Mm-hmm. And each of those are important economic countries, but of course they're as one market, they're significantly smaller than the United States. Again, taken together, it's a very good market, but it's especially in part in regards to language, but also some local things. It is much more heterogeneous than the United States. But the way you sell software works exactly the same. I think that's the cool thing. What we're seeing, if we have a great product, and all of our products are product-led growth. So, you know, we put them out there. People can sign up. We do online marketing. We do very little sales, but people just sign up, and then people just sign up from all over the world, which is very rewarding. We don't think in terms of, oh, you know, we'll tackle this one market, but we'd rather open it up and then, of course, do some targeted marketing in certain markets. But generally, we're very agnostic to where customers are. And that's fun because it also makes our customer base a lot more diverse. And then really kind of selling into Europe is very similar. I mean, unless, you know, you sell super specific vertical market software, not a market we're in, but, you know, suppose you'd sell software for the energy industry. The energy industry is super heterogeneous. It's like, even in the United States, kind of a state by state, it's run very differently. But like in Europe, you know, you multiply this by 10 and you think of, okay, France, very different models than Germany. Then, you know, it doesn't work. But the type of software we have, general interest software, we have a lot of online marketing software, we have a lot of developer tools, a lot of productivity software, general interest software. It's like the world's been very, very similar in that mm-hmm. regard, and the needs of customers and users are very similar.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, looking at the GDP of the countries in Europe, I personally didn't find it proportional exactly with the size of the SaaS industry or the software industry they have. Mm-hmm. And it was surprising to me that some countries maybe being ranked as number 8 might be in SaaS industry or software industry ranked as number 3. And that was surprising to me. And maybe that's because some of these countries, they had a strong base of the software. Because, for example, if you look at Sweden, with mm-hmm. so many good kind of technology companies that started there, they built that base that then many of these companies were kind of people coming out of those companies that started their own, and the ecosystem.
Sweden is an economic outlier. I was very fortunate in the year 2000 to study in Sweden at the Stockholm School of Economics. And back then, for example, in Germany, entrepreneurial nature was, like in software, was not prevalent. Mm-hmm. And Sweden was absolutely ahead of the curve. And there's a good, like they laid the ground back then for why we have Spotify and Klarna and many others. The others have followed. France has been doing a good job in actually nurturing their industry. Germany, but there's still a lot of them. Like there's still a big distinction between the European internet and software industry, with very few exceptions, like SAP, for example, in Germany, compared to its US counterparts. Generally, the industry is a lot more decentralized. And that's also a bit, maybe our model in a way is Germany. If you think about the industrial base, there is this term in Germany of the Mittelstand, which has become almost a bit of a term. And in Germany, we have a lot of like really small, like hidden champions. They produce something. They're like world market leaders. I heard the other day there was somebody who was world market leader for flag posts by a wide margin. And it's like, okay, it's a very small industry, but you know, a flag post is a flag post in the United States just as much as Germany. Just the flag people pull up is different, but the flag post, and that's a cool market, but it's probably just this company, I don't know, probably makes 100 million in revenues or something. It's a niche market. But Germany is like that. It has a lot, like a strong industrial base, but very decentralized. We don't have the NVIDIAs of this, of the world. But we have this broad base. And I think software is no different. Like we have the big beacons of software, Salesforce and others. But then we also have this software Mittelstand, which really deserves its spot in the world, because it's essentially a lot of great founders that have, as I said earlier, build up businesses that each serve a real niche, and they make millions in revenue, and combined together, they're actually quite strong and serve quite a purpose. And that's a bit what we're trying to build with SaaS Group, the fertile ground for that.
And do you have any particular advice for founders of these software companies that they are reaching to a point that they have, you know, passed, for example, 1 million euro or $1 million, recurring revenue? So that is kind of, as you said, very not so easy to get there, but it still is very, very a small number, but it still is a good accomplishment for many of these founders that they got to that point, and now they are growing and they are, you know, moving from 1 to 2 to 5 to, you know, that kind of area of the revenue that they are building and growing. What is your advice to a founder based on everything you have learned from talking to so many founders and acquiring some of them, the companies? What do you see as a pattern that you would say this will save you time and money, and you are putting your best years of your life to really grow and build and grow these businesses? And probably you would appreciate this particular, maybe one or two advices I can provide you that I have observed.
Yeah, I mean, great question. That's what a lot of founders ask themselves before they come to us. That could fill its own podcast. Maybe I'll do a shameless plug. We have an M&A course at SaaS Group, a free one, just for that question. It was like from the question on should I sell, why should I sell, to how do I prep for a sale, what are valuations, and so on and so forth. It's for free on our website. But if I can say one thing, and I would start with the kind of the why in the beginning, I would advise every founder to really question him or herself on why am I doing what I'm doing? Do I still enjoy what I'm doing? And where do I want to go? And then really kind of do some soul searching. If as a founder you say, hey, you know, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing, and I see a path from 2 million to 10 million, and I have fun every day executing, don't sell, just keep going. But if you're like, oh, you know, 2 million, but every day, 2 million revenue, but every day feels hard, I really have no idea how to get to 10, I want to have the thrill back of building stuff. And also, you know, I don't want to have all my eggs in one basket. That's an argument I hear more and more with the AI shift we've been talking about earlier. Well, then think about selling, because then, you know, you're going to be miserable. You're also going to be miserable in case your business does tank. For us, you know, it's okay if two or three businesses tank. We have almost 30 businesses. But for a founder, you really have all your eggs in one basket. So if you don't like this and you feel miserable, then consider selling. But I really would really ask yourself is like, why are you doing this? And am I still having fun? I think it really starts with this question. Everything else is execution.
And when you look at some of these founders that have been successful to get to the point of maybe $5 million or $6, $7 million revenue faster than others, and when you look at their business, it's a business that you think it's clean and they did a good job, and they, you know, maybe for a different reason they are coming to you and selling because, as you said, either they wanted to hedge their kind of risk, or maybe they just wanted to have a more predictable outcome rather than if at that point they go and raise money from institutional investor, they may lose control and they don't know exactly what would happen afterward. So what is the pattern you see? That this is the pattern I see with these kind of founders. And I know there might be many different several patterns, but what is that single pattern that when you see it, you love it because you know that this company is really good one, and you are very interested because of that characteristic that you see?
We like lean companies. The more you've achieved with fewer people, lean processes, very clear focus, like serving one group of people really well and not 10 groups of people in a mediocre way, good founders with a product and tech obsession that really have built a remarkable product. That's what we love.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Because that's the core. You want it to have a very strong core.
And marketing, we can scale, we can advise with pricing, we can take some of the nitty-gritty stuff of hiring and sales and customer service. That's all execution. But the product, you have to nail it, and you have to really live it and breathe it. And that's what we want to see, because then also we have a good base of actually taking that company to the next level. And that's really our aspiration.
You mentioned many of your people are kind of, they have a nomad living style, and they go, even Americans living in Spain or Portugal or some other places. I travel a lot as well. Mm-hmm. You have been traveling probably a lot and talking to these companies and, you know, going around the world. Let me ask you this question. Out of all of the cities that you have traveled, if you wanted to recommend a city for me to go and just see it in the next 2 weeks, or maybe not these 2 weeks, maybe you recommend another 2 weeks with a better weather or something, what would be that city that you would say, Armand, go and just visit this city, you would love it, I loved it?
That's a great question. A lot of great cities, in particular in Europe, we're fortunate to have so many different ones. Portugal Absolutely. Is great. I think there's a reason why so many people are in Lisbon. I personally like Barcelona as well. Paris is very close for me. It's a 3-hour train ride, but that's an obvious choice. Sometimes also the smaller cities off the beaten track. We did our last leadership meeting at SAS Group. We did in Gdansk in Poland, right at the coast. Beautiful city, small but beautiful. Most people go to Prague, which is kind of a larger version of it. This one is tiny, but super, super cute, super well rebuilt and everything, right at the sea. Lots of my hometown, Freiburg. It's also okay. one, the ones off the beaten track. It's a very picturesque city nestling, in the Black Forest in Germany. So
fantastic. No, we always love Germany. And every time we have been there, we have been impressed with the country itself, the people. I mean, lovely memories we have from that country. And I have some relatives there. So
glad to hear that.
Definitely. Thank you very much for the suggestions. And my last question, it's about a book that you liked personally or professionally and you would like to share with the audience.
Yeah, so I'll share a fiction book and a nonfiction book. So on the nonfiction side, staying at SAS Group, there's a book called Humanocracy, which I really enjoy reading. And it's about decentralized organizations, about empowering people, about using market-based principles instead of hierarchies. And I got it from a friend about two or three years ago. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's actually a lot on how we build SAS Group, but also I learned a lot on how to improve SAS Group. And so that one is a strong recommendation, Humanocracy. And then on a mix of actually fiction and nonfiction, and I do want to recommend it because it's a topic which is near and dear to my heart, and it's a bit forgotten in the current time where we have a lot of political leaders that are erring on both sides of the Atlantic in very different directions. It's called The Ministry of the Future. It's by an American author who writes a semi-fictional book, but partially fiction, partially non-fiction, on the climate crisis and what humanity, like how it could unfold in 5 to 10 years from now. So it's in the very distant future, a very non-distant future, and also how humanity could react. It's very impressive, and it's a topic there was a time when that topic got the attention it deserved, and it's now fallen out of the news. But physics, I would say, is shouldn't be falling out of the news. So I would really recommend that book because there's a real truth core to it, but it's also fascinating to me. Ministry of the Future.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you, Tim. This was a great conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to sasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.